This is an ABC podcast.
Hey, podcast fan, here is a chance to catch a favourite program from the year that was. It's a wild thought experiment, and I want you to join me on it. I want you to imagine a clock. But this is a clock like no other. This clock is designed to tick for 10,000 years into the future without any human intervention.
If you're going to try to build anything to last that long, well, what are your design principles? How do you, you know, what materials do you use?
The 10,000-year clock will tick once a year.
If it's going to be like a mechanical thing, physical thing, where do you site it such that it would be as protected from the elements as it needs to be?
It will bong once a century.
What about human discovery and interference? are people going to mess with this? What are they going to think of this?
Or will it just go rusty?
And will it just, you have to make sure you're using materials that aren't going to rust.
And the clock's cuckoo, it's going to chime every millennium. Think of it as a kind of heartbeat of humanity. It's a real clock, as you'll hear, to help us all imagine what the world will be in 10,000 years, which is the thought experiment of this episode.
They were trying to figure out a way to get around having to use ball bearings. The clock that they've built now does actually use a kind of bearing, a ceramic bearing. At the time, all of the materials that they thought they would be able to use, you know, with the friction and the heat over that period of time would just
melt,
you know, so you couldn't use bearings in any kind of a mechanical movement. And that was a real challenge.
A challenge that's been taken up by an outfit in San Francisco called the Long Now Foundation, where linguist Laura Welcher is the director of operations. In fact, it started with a conversation that musician Brian Eno, a founding board member, had with a friend when he was visiting New York. They were thinking about the expression, here and now.
For her, here meant right here, this room, and now meant this moment or this 5 minutes. And he was used to thinking of here and now more as being the times we're in, the region that we're in, and was thinking about the importance of having some kind of counterpoint in society to short-term thinking.
Recently, the first global conference on the future was held in Toronto.
This is Aldous Huxley, a man haunted by a vision of hell on earth. A searing social critic, Mr. Huxley, 27 years ago, wrote Brave New World, a novel that predicted that someday the entire world would live under a frightful dictatorship.
We mustn't be caught by surprise by our own advancing technology. This has happened again and again in history.
How do we encourage long-term thinking?
The state of mind.
The state
of mind.
That is
long-term thinking.
Yeah. You know, we have ideas in our society that we need to take care of our children, and then we have the seven generations concept. You know, we should be thinking generations ahead. But what if we stretch that out even longer? What can be the scope of our human agency and responsibility? Could it even be civilizational? Could we be thinking of ourselves as being good stewards of our civilization? So he proposed this term, the long now, looking backwards into the past to the dawn of human agriculture and civilization. And that puts you at about 10,000 years ago. And if we take that time period and we project it into the future, another 10,000 years, we propose that as being your long now.
So the Long Now Foundation wants to create mechanisms and myths that help us all think more long term, to think for the long now. And we're doing that here on the show too, challenging the present obsession with short term thinking.
The human psyche, the whole political enterprise even more so, is oriented towards solving problems that are perceived to be immediately threatening.
Raymond Pierre Humbert studies planets outside our solar system. They're called exoplanets.
What the exoplanet studies do give us an idea of is what makes Earth special. And we're building towards the question of, are there a lot of other planets like Earth out there that could bear life, or are we really the only ones? If we're really the only ones in the universe, then that makes our custodianship of the flame of life the torch of life and intelligence even more precious. It makes it even more critical that we not trash this home that we have.
Ray is a leading climate scientist too and Halley Professor of Physics at Oxford University.
And just about the only only cultural institutions that really think on the timescale of even many centuries are religious institutions, which will build a cathedral like Notre Dame over several centuries, or the enterprise of science or universities. There were, for example, Chinese eclipse observers and Babylonian eclipse observers that, without any idea how people would use their data, took such good data that we can use that today to study the rate at which the Earth's rotation is slowing down and things like that. And so there is some precedent of thinking over the timescale of millennia, but the political enterprise is just wired into thinking about the cycle to the next election.
From political cycles to presidential terms, business quarters to short-term research funding, can we be more strategic? Can we plan for the next 10 millennia even? Is it possible to imagine what the world might be, what our species might be 10,000 years from now? Shall we give it a go?
That very slow, imperceptible dance that the tectonic plates have made across the surface of the Earth, suddenly you've now got the ability to pick apart every different interval, every different window into that journey and see what was going on at that time.
If geologist and geochemist Tom Raimondo can do it,
I guess there's the running joke.
Then why can't we all?
That a geologist doesn't get out of bed for anything less than a million years. So 10,000 years is only the blink of an eye, really, geologically speaking. As a geologist, you really do spend more time thinking about the topic of time than any other topic, because it really governs everything we know and understand about how the world operates. An analogy that's often used, I guess, is if you take the entire window of Earth's history, 4.5 billion years to the present, and compare it to a 24-hour clock, where midnight is the advent of the Earth, the birth of the Earth, 4.5 billion years ago, and we're inching our way or ticking our way towards midnight again. The entirety of human existence has only been around for less than a second. And our own experience is even a fraction of that, even a period of 10,000 years, how much that represents in the context of the Earth as a whole. It's so vanishingly small.
Well under a second.
Yes, exactly.
So we've got no excuse, right? And perhaps the 10,000-year clock might help us. It sounds fantastical, but this is in fact a real artifact in the making.
It is being constructed inside of a giant limestone cliff in West Texas, and it's being specially excavated for the clock.
It's enormous.
It's 150 meters tall.
Wow.
And the clock is being assembled like this giant ship in a bottle inside of this shaft.
The clock is the vision of tech pioneer Danny Hillis, one of the co-founders of the Long Now Foundation. Ironically, his name as an inventor is synonymous with things that are super fast, supercomputers. But now he's slowing things right down. If you drive 7 hours from the nearest airport in Texas into the 950 million-year-old Sierra Diablo Mountains and you climb 600 metres above the valley floor, there you'll find the giant clock under construction.
And so the drill bit just kind of ground and grinds and grinds and grinds. It goes very slowly. And, you know, it was weeks later that it actually kind of came out the top. And then all of the rock, you know, filled the bottom chamber that they'd excavated, and they took that out. So now you have this large cylinder. This becomes the chamber that they're going to assemble the main mechanism of the clock.
As we know, mechanical clocks slow down over time. Will this slow down?
There might be a tiny bit of drift. So the main energy input is sunlight. The other thing that the window to the sun does is it provides a correction to solar noon, which is plus or minus 15 minutes. And you have to expect that over 10,000 years, there might be periods without a lot of sunlight. But when the sun comes out again, then it provides the sync up to solar noon.
Yes, it's a big assumption that the sun will always be able to hit that sapphire roof of the clock's porthole.
Mm-hmm.
It may not.
It may not.
We may end up with, you know, cloud cover or particulate cover or, you know, natural disasters clouding over the access.
Mm-hmm. It can reasonably keep time for 10,000 years, and then it needs periodic access to sunlight to do these corrections. And then the other idea behind the clock, you know, Danny Hillis has said that the clock can withstand neglect, but it responds to love. So, yeah, it invites non-malicious human interaction. So the clock is designed for people. Its operations are transparent. There's nothing kind of happening behind closed doors. It's with materials that have been around since the Bronze Age. You know, upon close inspection, somebody who studies it is able to figure out how this works. And, you know, we can expect people to be interacting with it, maybe even maintaining it over 10,000 years. That's a possibility. But in the absence of that, there's still a clock in the mountain and it's still ticking. For many people, it is almost absurd and it's intended to be provocative, but at the same time, we're actually engaging in projects that take that time frame very seriously and build things that are intended to be kind of mythic in stature as a way to inspire people to take a larger view of their own point in time themselves, right? So by the fact that we are doing it, we're giving permission to others to think longer.
And it's there as a potent symbol, a timekeeping device, if you like, of long-term thinking. Laura Welcher from the Long Now Foundation. And check out one of their other projects on our Science Friction website, the Rosetta Disc Project. What do we want to tell future beings about the thousands of human languages of today? Languages that might be long dead or dying or still alive in 10 millennia from now. But what will the world look like then? What conditions will that clock ticking out the centuries inside the mountain in West Texas come up against? To think about that question, we kind of need to look to the past 10,000 years.
So if you think about
geologist Tom Raimondo,
the rising of mountains from beneath the ocean and then eroding them down to dust, you think of this dance of the continents over the surface and migrating from poles to the tropics and back again. If you think about species coming into and out of existence, these huge variations in climate that have gone on in the past. You know, you've got virtually every change that you can imagine and many more that you can't imagine that have gone on within that interval. So having that understanding of time and the passage of time in the context of geology really gives you that appreciation that perhaps no other discipline does.
How did you shift your perception of perhaps yourself in the world, of us as a species in the world, when you started projecting across millennia rather than moments?
The word perspective comes up. Viewing yourself much more as a speck of dust or a marble, sitting on a marble hovering in space, you certainly get that appreciation from geology and planetary science. You get an appreciation of how we are total anomalies, I guess, in the context of Earth history, in terms of the rate and the extent of change that we're able to produce via our own doing in such a short time in Earth's total history. Don't get me wrong, there have been extreme and devastating events all through Earth's history that are done by the force of nature, and those forces are far greater than anything that we can manipulate. But the impact we're having is across so many different facets of the Earth system. On biodiversity, for example, on the trace element signature that we find in sediments, for example, by a variety of human-made products that we're leaving across the surface, and a variety of other ways that humans are impacting the Earth system in ways that are reasonably unprecedented, I guess, in the context of the Earth as a whole.
But does our impact rival the influence of the slow grind of geological time?
Probably not, no. You'd have to say that we're still just a blip, I guess, in the journey of the Earth's history. Every species has left behind a signature of their existence. We're just the first ones to consciously control that and to have some sort of responsibility over the legacy that we're leaving. Because there will be literally a crime scene of evidence that the human race is leaving behind in terms of the changes that it's influenced since its existence. So that's pause for thought.
A kilogram of carbon dioxide that we emit today will still be having an influence on the climate 10,000 years from now.
Oxford geophysicist and astrophysicist Ray Pierre Humbert.
And so the decisions we make about how much carbon dioxide we emit in the next 50 years will be determining the climate that our descendants, if they survive, will be living with for the next 10,000 years. It's as if the first city dwellers and developers of agriculture on the Fertile Crescent did something that irreversibly changed the climate we're living with today and would make the environment for us much more adverse than we have.
Ray, you don't just pull 10,000 years out of the air when it comes to climate change and the impacts of what we do now, 10,000 years from now. You have modelled this with colleagues, haven't you?
That's right. I was part of a paper that involved dozens of authors from all different areas of science that have studied the imprint of our carbon dioxide emissions over the next 10,000 years. We picked 10,000 years mainly because we have really accurate data going 10,000 years in the past. And so comparing the next 10,000 years to the previous 10,000 years to give an idea of the enormous magnitude of our imprint on climate was a nice round number. In fact, it takes more like 100,000 years for the human effect on climate due to carbon dioxide emissions to really recover.
What was at the heart of the motivation of that exercise for you?
Oh, it was really to bring home the fact that we are in a new geological era, just like we name past times, the Holocene, the Eocene, and so forth. We're in a new period of time called the Anthropocene, in which the impersonal forces of geology are no longer in the driver's seat of climate. It's the decisions that we make over the next century that will set the climate and many other aspects of the environment, including whether or not you've got ice on Greenland and the West Antarctic and East Antarctic ice sheets. We are in the driver's seat that will determine all those things for the next 10,000 and to some extent even for the next 100,000 years, unless we develop some completely new kind of technology for scrubbing carbon dioxide out of the air.
But to a geologist like Associate Professor Tom Raimondo from the University of South Australia, well, 10,000 years is quite enough time for the impersonal forces of geology to make big changes too. Can we try this thought experiment? Let's think about the big geological and environmental changes of the past 10,000 years to consider what that clock might encounter in the next 10,000 years.
So one of the most substantial changes that has happened on the present day Earth in the past 10,000 years is sea level change. So we've gone from this period of being dominantly covered by ice to being dominantly having free water in the oceans. And the extent of change has been maybe 50 metres or thereabouts at its greatest, and maybe 120 metres if you cast your way back all the way to the glacial maximum about 20,000 years ago. I guess Texas might be either a long way from the ocean, even further than it is now, or totally submersed in water. So that's a huge change to our coastlines, to our land masses, to the environments that they experience, to the ecosystems that exist within those environments. So there's certainly a very real chance that that clock will be situated in an environment unlike anything that we can anticipate right now.
Thanks to forces beyond our control. What about the movement of tectonic plates and how they shuffle things around over that sort of timescale of 10,000 years?
So at the current rate that most tectonic plates are moving, it's generally a few centimetres a year up to maybe 30 or 50 at its really greatest. Within 10,000 years, you can do the calculation on the back of an envelope, really. It's pretty straightforward. Over 10,000 years, we might be talking several hundreds of metres, maybe a kilometre at the absolute most or thereabouts. That's not a huge amount of distance to move. Certainly would be a big distance if you try to find your way home and suddenly your home's, you know, a kilometre away from where it was last time.
And hopefully they've put the clock somewhere in the middle of a tectonic plate rather than at a perimeter between two.
Now, Texas is not particularly near any major tectonic plate boundaries or anything like that. So it's fairly secure in that sense. But there are all sorts of changes that over a 10,000-year timescale could occur that may have a more significant effect. A meteorite impact, for example, we may have no control, or we do have no control over where that would land. And, you know, one of the biggest in Earth's history landed in Mexico, in the Gulf of Mexico, so it's not that far away.
Aye, and so in the way that it wiped out the dinosaurs, it could wipe us out.
Yes.
and the clock with it.
Exactly right, yes.
But back to those climate change models, based on theoretical predictions but verified by real-world observations, both past and present, and by lab experiments, Raymond Pierre Humbert and colleagues have used them to consider what the next 10 millennia will bring.
By some estimates, there are about 5 trillion tons of carbon in fossil fuels available for burning. It's a kind of a fuzzy number. But so let's call that business as usual, where we burn the whole estimated reserves of coal, oil, natural gas. In that case, even in the middle range of our estimates of how sensitive climate is, you're looking at a situation where about half the Earth becomes uninhabitable for mammals outdoors. Greenland, over the next 5 to 10,000 years, has become devoid of ice. Sea level has risen at least 7 meters, drowning a lot of Florida, many coastal cities, millions and millions of people having to migrate, severe impact in Bangladesh. And that's on top of whatever other stresses the world may be going under because of geopolitical stresses. If we did burn all the reserves in the next 200 years, then the heat waves I was talking about would be there essentially right away. But things like sea level rise and glacier melt, they take time to catch up. Things like melting Greenland are generally believed to take about 5,000 years to complete.
But it might not even be our species that experiences any of this in 10,000 years' time. We might have done our dash.
In the normal course of events, the human species has been around for a length of time that is similar to the lifespan of many species from the past. So we're by no means a young species. But in the exoplanet community, when we discuss why we haven't gotten any signals from any place else, despite the fact that there are billions and billions of other planets out there, probably billions and billions that have a climate similar to Earth. One of the ideas that keeps coming up is that maybe intelligence is not a very good adaptation, that it does give us the ability to do things that what you might call natural, unintelligent, undirected processes can't do, make compounds like ozone-destroying compounds like chlorofluorocarbons, release deeply buried carbon very quickly, and biologically engineer, genetically engineer pathogens that could be much more lethal than anything nature produces without intelligent, if unwise, direction.
So interesting. This is a question. In fact, our superintelligence might be ultimately self-limiting. Does it matter if our species doesn't continue?
Well,
just putting it out there.
I actually do think that intelligence is a rather precious kind of a miracle. Art, the scientific advances, the fact that a little species like us in an insignificant arm of the galaxy can build a device that detects gravitational radiation and is able to observe colliding and merging black holes billions of light years away. That's really remarkable, the extent to which we've understood the universe from its very beginnings to what's going to happen in a trillion years. The level of understanding plus the level of cultural achievement at our best is just astonishing. And even if there are other intelligent species out there, allowing our own species to disappear would be like taking a torch to a Picasso.
But for all this talk about the distant, distant future, geologist Tom Raimondo finds himself, at night at least, often dreaming much more about the past.
Don't get me wrong, I love Back to the Future. I love that whole vision of the future with flying cars and all these other things. But that all seems like fantasy to me, I guess, in some way. Maybe that's what it is. If you're thinking about the past, it's not fantasy. It's happened. It's concrete. It's real.
In some sense, this is the power of a clock steadily ticking us into the future over 10 millennia. It helps us project our imagination to a possible future. We need a kind of anchor to help us do that.
That's right, a reference frame, I guess. Some sort of perceptible chime that's there ticking in the back of your mind, or in reality actually ticking there. If you can imagine this clock very, very slowly ticking its way through that series of movements towards the final cuckoo coming out at 10,000 years into the future.
People have often told me, people in policies, that there's no point in talking about 10,000 years. It's just not real to people. And I'm not really sure that's the case. To some extent, people are focused on the short term, but when you start thinking about a place for your future descendants to live in, then the future does become a little bit more real. And some studies do show that when people engage with the notion of the survival of the species as a whole, they do begin to care that the effects of humans on climate and on the environment is essentially irreversible.
Are you hopeful?
Am I hopeful? Well, despair isn't an option. The reason I'm hopeful is that actually the technology of renewables is coming along pretty quickly. We also could do a lot more with next generation of nuclear power than we're doing right now. The problem being that there isn't a real financial incentive to invest in nuclear at a time when natural gas is so cheap. But there are solutions. There are technological solutions that don't even involve much of a hit to the world economy. In fact, probably are a boost to the world economy. It's not a situation where we don't actually have solutions. And so if we actually do manage to convince people that these solutions to decarbonization will make their life better, then that will be a game changer. And so I have enough faith in human nature that although we as humans tend to make all mistakes possible, we eventually do the right thing.
And you can find out more about the 10,000 year clock over on the Science Friction website. Email us from there too, or talk to me on Twitter at Natasha Mitchell. The show is produced by myself, Anne Maria Tickle, and studio engineer John Jacobs. Hey, next time, well, it's an eye-opening and rollicking her story from the history of science, and it's a juicy scandal. Was the godfather of climate science, in fact, a woman?
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.